Hello, this is Lauren Chang, Managing Editor of Competition Policy International. I have the pleasure today of introducing Mark Levinson to the CPI community. Mark Levinson is an economist as well as a historian. Among other stops in his career, he has been finance and economics editor of The Economist magazine and spent a decade as an economist at a Wall Street bank. He has published 5 books. In 2006, his book, The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the World Economy Bigger, won many awards for showing how a seemingly simple invention, the standard shipping container, made globalization possible. His most recent book, published this past September, is titled Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. The book explores the fascinating history of the chain store wars, when politicians of all stripes supported a government crackdown on chains because their efficiency and low prices threatened the survival of independent retailers. Mark, I was wondering what it was about this particular case and topic that fascinated you enough to justify the time and effort required to produce an entire book on the subject?
A couple of things. One is that there has been a great deal of writing on Walmart, in recent years about Walmart's business practices and all of the things that they've created. Much of this has been very ahistorical. And if you look into the A&P story, you find that many of the methods that Walmart has used to reduce costs in retailing actually were pioneered by A&P in the 1920s, and some of them even earlier than the 1920s. So this goes back a very long time. The story in my book, The Great A&P, really goes to a very long-standing conflict within American society. On the one hand, we like the idea of capitalism and free enterprise. On the other hand, we're very uncomfortable with capitalism and free enterprise because capitalism means that some businesses go out of business. Some people lose their jobs. Big companies may get bigger, and smaller companies may not be able to survive. And that aspect of capitalism really makes us very important. So the Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America is really about this battle within American society and eventually within the American political process, as there were repeated efforts to protect small businesses from a big business that was much more efficient and operated with much lower costs for consumer benefit.
So the case actually disappeared during the Eisenhower administration, and A&P subsequently went bankrupt. But it seems as if the A&P specter has been reincarnated today, as you noted in the image of Walmart. So there's still a good deal of antagonism directed to big business in general, as exemplified by the Occupy Wall Street movement. And in the A&P case, antitrust laws were used by the government to protect small businesses. Do you see that happening today with such trends as the FTC usage of Title V to aggressively prosecute antitrust violations, or the Dodd-Frank legislation to attack big financial institutions?
I think our understanding of what is fair competition has changed considerably from the A&P days. I'll give you a couple of examples. A&P in the 1920s, when it was already the biggest retailer in the world, began to integrate vertically. It purchased or started up bakeries, salmon canning plants, milk plants, and so on and so forth. So it became a large food processor. This was regarded by very many people as unfair, not because it was unprofitable, but because A&P could, if it chose to, try to book more profit in its food processing business and less profit on the retail end of its business. And, of course, small merchants couldn't do this. So it was regarded as not right that that a company should be able to do this. It should have to make the same profit on the items in its store as every other merchant. We wouldn't really think about it in those terms today. it was regarded very widely as unfair that there was price discrimination, that a big company such as A&P could buy its merchandise at a lower unit cost than a mom-and-pop store. Well, of course, A&P was buying 10 railroad freight cars at a time, and the mom-and-pop store was buying a single case. So there were economic differences that justified differences in prices, but this was regarded as unfair treatment, and there were decades of efforts to prohibit price discrimination, culminating in the Robinson-Patman Act. So we don't see that today. We do think differently about some of these things. On the other hand, some of these things haven't changed. You referred to the Occupy Wall Street movement, for example. Well, the Occupy Wall Street movement is a movement that at its heart is very concerned with size, distant forces, big business. The anti-chain store movement was very similar. And the anti-chain store movement was really quite successful. It lasted from the 1920s into the 1950s. And its result was that mom-and-pop stores actually grew in number during that period. They managed to fend off the chains sufficiently that there were more mom-and-pop stores by the end of the 1940s than there were in the 1920s. So the anti-chain movement was quite successful. I would say the big difference with Occupy Wall Street is that the anti-chain movement had a very simple and clear objective, which was keep mom-and-pop in business. And it concentrated its efforts around that with great success.
So I'd like to shift to actually a related but still very important theme that you also highlight in your book, which is the almost complete lack of economic analysis used in A&P. And since then, there's been much discourse over the role of economists in similar cases, with many arguing that economic analysis is being overused and actually triumphing over common sense, and that judges and the public can't even understand them. Where does your book stand on the role of economic analysis in antitrust?
Well, I would not dispute your contention that economic analysis is overused, and I think in current times you see economists coming up with very, very fancy models that don't necessarily have much correspondence with reality. In the attacks on A&P and on chain stores from the 20s into the 50s, there was essentially no economic analysis. This was not really part of competition policy whatsoever in the United States at this time. So you had no serious look at whether, for example, a company like A&P was able to reduce costs because of greater efficiency. There were, in fact, huge consumer benefits from this company. A&P underpriced competitors. There were numerous studies of grocery prices where school classes or university professors would go out and buy a basket of merchandise at the A&P store, and they'd price the same basket at various mom-and-pop stores, and A&P was steadily 10 to 15% cheaper than mom-and-pop. So there was a clear consumer benefit here. But there was no real scrutiny of the logic of many of the claims that were made by the chain store opponents. For example, was it really a bad thing that a store like A&P did not charge the same price at every store in the state? Okay, think about it. There were states that passed laws requiring that a chain store had the same price on every item on every store in the state, and if it didn't do that, it was trading unfairly. There were many states, probably most states, had laws requiring minimum markups on merchandise. No one looked to see whether a store such as A&P had lower operating costs and therefore could justify a lower markup. That was not part of the consideration. It was simply that there had to be a markup of 8% or 10% or whatever the state legislature decided on each item. And similarly, when the federal government filed an antitrust case against A&P in 1942 for selling groceries too cheaply, its claims were simply not subject to scrutiny in court. So you had witnesses coming and saying things like, A&P was trading unfairly because it put its own store brands in prominent positions in the store, and the nationally advertised brands were hidden away in the corner. Well, is that necessarily a bad thing if it's true? Does that really hurt consumers? Is anyone damaged by that except perhaps the manufacturer of the nationally advertised brand? There was no scrutiny of whether this claim made any sense. And that was really true for all of the government's claims in the case. This is a long line of thought that actually goes back to Louis Brandeis, before he became Justice Brandeis. Brandeis was a prominent lawyer, and he argued back in 1913 that discounting is bad for consumers. It brings no consumer benefit, because even though a consumer might pay a lower price now, the lower price is going to drive some merchants out of business. The survivor will be a monopolist, and the consumer is going to end up paying a lot more. Well, is that actually likely to happen in the food retail industry? I'd argue that it's almost impossible to have a monopoly in food retailing. But again, there was no serious economic scrutiny of that sort of claim.
Well, thanks for the details on, you know, the legal history behind economic analysis and the concerns. And next, let's take a step back and take sort of a big picture view of the message in your book, which you say the A&P case actually dealt with competing visions of society. And one vision favored the rationalism of cold corporate efficiency as a way to increase wealth and raise living standards. The other vision of society was one that went back to a society of autonomous and independent farmers, craftsmen, and merchants, in which personal independence was the source of opportunity and prosperity. So, until recently, accepted wisdom was that Europe still held to the second theory, the one of small farmers and businessmen, which was actually holding them back from economic development, while the United States was an advocate of corporate efficiency. Do you think this idea has now been overturned?
I don't think it's been overturned. I think that the different countries have dealt with this in different ways. You still see in many countries restrictions on big retailers to help mom and pop, to protect the main street stores. Often this is accompanied by very, very gauzy memories of how wonderful a mom and pop stores are or how they used to be, when in fact the mom and pop stores don't offer anything that the chains don't offer, except perhaps higher prices. But you see still in many European countries various protections in place for mom and pop. Some of them have gone away, but it can still be difficult to site larger stores. There are still, in some countries, restrictions on what can be sold in a certain type of store, so one store can't get into another store's business. There are some countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, where there are still limits on store opening hours or on the size of stores. So there's an ambivalence in Europe, and you see this as well in Asia. It's not limited to the United States by any means.
I'd like to end our conversation by looking toward the future for you. Are you considering a new book, and could you share a sneak peek with us?
I really can't. I've got some new projects underway, but They're not quite ready for prime time yet, so I'd like to have them scoped out a bit more before I do talk about them.
Oh, well, that's fine. You've given us a lot to think about in the meantime. A great comparative look at Europe and U.S. and AP and the relevance to today's issues. So I'd like to thank you for a very interesting interview, and best of luck with your new projects, Mark.
Thank you, Lauren, very much.